It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, are Russia's provocative moves in Ukraine a geopolitical game changer? How can the United States and the European Union combat Moscow's attempts to destabilize Ukraine? U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says that some of the individual special operations personnel who were active on Russia's behalf in Chechnya, Georgia, and Crimea have been photographed in the eastern cities of Slovyansk, Donetsk, and Luhansk. Furthermore, Moscow has engaged in a massive propaganda campaign to discredit Kiev and the West, essentially blaming them for the current turmoil. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The showdown over Ukraine began last November when then-President Viktor Yanukovych spurned an association agreement with the European Union in favor of closer ties to Russia. Moscow had strongly opposed the EU deal, which would have anchored Ukraine, a former Soviet republic, in the West. What began as peaceful demonstrations eventually turned deadly as protesters clashed with police and Yanukovych fled the country. Russian President Vladimir Putin never recognized the interim government in Kiev, calling it illegitimate, fascist, and anti-Semitic, despite no evidence to support such allegations. In March, in violation of the Budapest Memorandum of 1994, under which Russia, America, and Britain guaranteed Ukraine's integrity in exchange for the country giving up its nuclear arsenal, Putin engineered an invasion of Crimea, part of Ukraine's sovereign territory, under the pretext of protecting ethnic Russians. The seizure of Crimea has fueled a debate about whether Russian forces might try to take advantage of Ukraine's military weakness and roll over the border to seize more territory. Russia has reportedly dramatically increased the number of troops deployed along its border with Ukraine to about 80,000. Washington is sending a total of about 600 paratroopers to Poland and three Baltic states in response to, quote, Russia's aggression in Ukraine. And U.S. President Barack Obama criticized Russia's meddling in eastern Ukraine, telling reporters in Seoul that he would talk with key European leaders about implementing wider sanctions in the event Russia further escalates the situation. Washington has accused Moscow of failing to uphold the four-party deal it signed last week, calling for all parties in Ukraine to lay down their weapons and vacate public buildings. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Moscow has not taken a single step to de-escalate tensions since the deal was signed in Geneva. The showdown over Ukraine is being dubbed one of the most serious East-West confrontations since the Cold War. For more on the crisis in Ukraine, its destabilizing effect on the region, and its impact on U.S.-Russian relations, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Ariel Cohen is a senior research fellow in Russian and Eurasian studies and international energy policy at the Heritage Foundation here in Washington, and William Pomerantz. He's the deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars, also here in Washington. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure.
Ariel Cohen, let me begin with you. Your thoughts about where we are right now, the escalation, the Ukrainian so-called anti-terror operations, and where is this all going?
Well, this is probably the most serious security crisis of the 21st century so far. It has at least two components I can see. One is the regional component. It's relationship between Russia and Ukraine. Ukraine, of course, was partitioned and occupied by Russia and Poland and Turkey, even before the partitions of Poland. And Russia today is reverting to the rhetoric that we did not see since the Tsarist times, denying the Ukrainians peoplehood, national identity, statehood and language. One of the top Russian propagandists, Margarita Simonyan, the head of RT TV channel, tweeted, "Ukraine, RIP, rest in peace." This is nothing short of, I would say, near genocidal intent. When you deny a country its right to exist, it is very, very severe. It violates the UN Charter, and it raises very deep questions about security in Europe. But beyond that, the second part of this problem is what Russia is doing, bringing back ethnicity and culture as the base of foreign policy and not citizenship and established borders. This has implications because everyone has co-ethnics living across the border, and the darkest era of the 20th century, late 1930s and 40s, was cloaked in the protection of co-ethnics in Central Europe, in Austria with the Anschluss, and in Sudetenland with the reunification of the German-speaking people. And finally, this is the question about the post-World War II global order that for decades was based on American power. During the Cold War, the balance between the U.S. and the USSR, and after the end of the Cold War, it for a while looked like the triumph of liberal democracy. Some people even wrote books about the end of history, and as I quipped at that time, history did not end, neither did geography. Geography dictates what's going on around the world, including in Ukraine right now, and this is a very serious challenge to the Obama administration after setbacks in the Middle East, in East Asia, and now in Europe.
Turning to you, William Pomerantz, certainly regional problems insinuating that Ukraine perhaps shouldn't exist, RIP, rest in peace. We are going backwards, it seems. In addition to that, we have this whole challenge to the global world order, post-World War II order. How do you see the situation to date?
Well, Ariel is right that Russia has made this decision to deny notions of Ukrainian statehood and ethnicity. And it was very revealing when Putin pulled up his map of sometime during Catherine the Great's reign and pointed to New Russia, which of course denies all the things that occurred in Ukraine, or what was Ukraine, during the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. It was really a very blatant statement. And Ariel is right as well. The notion of Ukraine was always denied throughout the Tsarist period. There were massive restrictions on the use of Ukrainian language, Ukrainian culture. And the fact that somehow Putin has decided to retreat back to 18th century thinking is, of course, very dangerous in terms of the 21st century that we live in.
Okay, so we all agree it's very dangerous and escalating by the minute. So, Ariel Cohen, one more look back at history as if we could really change things, but it's important to put things in context. In retrospect, did the United States, did the European Union make some mistakes, perhaps, about expanding NATO and the EU into the former Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact countries? This does not justify in any way Putin's belligerent actions, but he talks about this sphere of influence in addition to ethnic groups and protecting ethnic minorities, Russian-speaking minorities. To what extent do you think the West is paying for what some say maybe were overzealous overtures to the former Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact countries?
What you described is an opinion, it's a minority opinion that prevails in Washington in what I would call the ultra-realist school. The people who could be identified maybe with the Nixon administration and with the Bush senior administration. There are some people like that. You hear this opinion that we should not have expanded NATO. I must say that both Republicans and Democrats in Clinton and Bush II administrations, so four administrations, were staunch supporters of Europe whole and free, of expanding NATO and the European Union, and if eventually the United States, the EU, and Japan end up in a free trade zone, together with Mexico and Canada, of course, this would be a tremendous achievement for freedom, for economic freedom, for the rule of law. So I am not an opponent of expansion of NATO. I think there may have been a tenuous opportunity to reach out to the Russians more and drag the Russians in inviting and pulling Russia into that center of gravity, including things like free travel to Europe, etc. Today, unfortunately, we passed that point. Mr. Putin believes that Russia can be a pole in the multipolar world. Whatever that is, what I think it really means to translate is that Russia will be a raw material appendage, not to the West, but to China. And if the Russians think that this is a preferable geopolitical outcome, so be it. But I would say if you have to apportion the responsibility here, It is the policy of reset with Russia that was, from the get-go, mistranslated. They said reset, and they translated it as overload. Instead of перезагрузка, they translated it as перегрузка. And that policy entailed the benign neglect, or so it looked for the time, and I strongly advocated and argued against the neglect of the new independent states of the former Soviet Union. I think signaling to Russia that we don't care about Georgia, we don't care about Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, we don't care about Ukraine, the downgrading of the relations when Mr. Obama did not visit any of these countries, it was a strong signal to the Russians, as were different arms embargoes to Georgia, etc., that we are no longer prioritizing Eurasia, be it because we are pivoting to the Middle East, or we're pivoting to Asia, or pivoting somewhere else, is not a good foreign policy.
Turning to you, William Pomerantz, we're not going to solve the problem by looking back, per se, but I think it's important as we go forward to understand the context. So the question to you again, the one I posed to Ariel, did the United States European Union make some mistakes in retrospect with regard to expanding NATO and the EU into the former Soviet Union? But conversely, what about mistakes more recently, whether via the Obama administration, the reset? Certainly, there's a lot of blame to go around as we try to analyze how we got to this point.
Well, I think there's blame to go around, but I do think we need to be forward-looking as we try to deal with this particular problem. I think there were lots of debate at the time of NATO expansion, should we not? And indeed, the intellectual founding member of the Kennan Institute, George Kennan himself, was against the expansion of NATO. And that being said, however, there have been numerous attempts to explain to Russia what NATO is, that it is a defensive alliance. There have been countless numbers of meetings between Russians and NATO through the council. So I don't think that the Russians are justified in saying there's some sort of misunderstanding of what NATO is. The other thing I think I want to point out in terms of did we make a mistake or did we not make mistakes, clearly one of the goals was to kind of bring Russia into different international institutions over the last 20 years. And that has proceeded at an uneven pace, but it has occurred, including Russia's becoming a member of the Council of Europe and Russia becoming a member of the WTO and other types of institutions. And what I think is interesting as we go forward is that, in fact, these institutions, a lot of people view them as powerless. A lot of them view them as Russia's beginning to corrupt them, having come from within. But I think what we've seen over the last few days is that by integrating Russia into these Western institutions, there is a way to cause direct consequences for some of Russia's actions. And this was admitted by Putin when he talked about the change in credit ratings, the lack of investment going into Russia, huge capital flight. These are all things that have resulted because Russia has slightly become more integrated in the world. And what I think Russia is about to get a lesson in is in the fact that they really cannot isolate themselves, as Errol was hinting, and create and exist as their own polar in a multipolar world. But in fact, Russia is subject to the law of economics, and it's going to suffer the consequences as a result of its actions in Ukraine.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ariel Cohen. He's a senior research fellow in Russian and Eurasian Studies and International Energy Policy at the Heritage Foundation, and William Pomerantz, from whom you just heard. He's deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington. And I'm Carol Castiel. We're discussing the crisis over Ukraine as Russia continues its provocative territorial moves. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. And as always, we love to hear from you. Please send us an email with your feedback to encounter@voanews.com. Well, back to you, Ariel Cohen, and let's take a look at the situation as it stands today with this very tense standoff in Ukraine with the Russians building up more and more troops along the border with a very robust propaganda campaign. This is not to say that there aren't Ukrainians in the East who are somewhat sympathetic, but I think if you did a poll, many would say they would rather remain in Ukraine as a united Ukraine. So we know there are provocateurs. We have evidence of special forces. What is Russia trying to do, in your view, both in the short and long term, You know, are they going to move in? Do they want to destabilize so elections can't take place? What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm going to address it momentarily, and I have 4 or 5 scenarios that they can implement. And from the get-go, I'll say that it took a lot of planning and training for the Russians to achieve the level of performance we see. This is very sophisticated warfare. The special forces performance in the Crimea, I must say, are probably going straight to a textbook of how you accomplish seizure of a pretty considerable province. I was born in Crimea. I love the Crimea. But it saddens me to see that in my lifetime, it was seized by military power. The last time there was an invasion of Crimea, that was by the Nazi troops. And there were genocidal executions, first of the Jews, and then when the Soviets came back, genocidal expulsion of the Crimean Tatars in 1944. But what I want to respond with to what my friend and colleague Will Pomeranz said is that we already see not just the decline in Russian economic performance from 7.5% growth before the 2009 crisis, very robust growth, to maybe 1% this year and possibly sliding into negative territory with Alexei Kudrin, by far the best Russian financier and economist, former deputy prime minister and finance minister, warning that this year $160 billion, close to 10% of the Russian GDP, may leave as a result of capital flight. And over this is an overlay of a rhetoric from Mr. Putin that surprises me. I've been in 10 meetings with Mr. Putin, who always strikes one as a competent manager, a knowledgeable person in the economic, especially in energy and oil and gas. But here he says, oh, the fact that there was foreign capital in establishment of Yandex, this is a serious threat and implications to Russian national security. The Yandex founders replied and said, Mr. Putin, there is such thing as venture capital. There's such thing as investment funds. That's where the money came from. It did not come from the CIA. Will, you're saying Russia cannot go back. I would like to agree with you, but at the same time, I read people like Sergei Glazyev that forcefully are advocating Russia going autarkic, Russia going neo-Soviet, Russia increasing the role of the state, becoming étatiste, if not centrally planned. And Sergei Glazyev happens to be Putin's key economic and geographic advisor, including playing a key role on recapturing an Anschluss of Ukraine.
So you just answered my question. So that means, all of that means that they're going to grab Ukraine.
Back to my 4 scenarios.
Okay.
The first scenario is do nothing. You know, rattle the cage and stay back. I don't think this is going to happen. They're too much invested now in terms of the military assets on the ground, in terms of propaganda assaults, in terms of international diplomatic efforts for Russia to totally go back. Then the question is, what are you doing? Are you destabilizing enough to stop the elections, as the Russian and pro-Russian spokespeople are saying in Ukraine? There's going to be no elections. Or pushing for federalization, meaning what the Russians and pro-Russian forces are demanding is that each oblast, each region will basically have its own policy, but also the governors will have a lot of say in Ukrainian national policy. They would be in the position to veto joining the European Union, NATO in the future, etc. And my 3 scenarios on the ground: take Donbas, take eastern Ukraine only, take Donbas in the south, all the way to port cities of Nikolaev and Odessa, and hook up with the secessionist Transnistria area in Moldova. That's scenario number 3. And number 4, take over all of Ukraine so that you can suppress the nationalist kernel in the western corner of Ukraine, the area in which there was a very serious insurgency after the Soviet occupation from 39 all the way into the 50s, and tens of thousands of people were killed, hundreds of thousands were arrested and exiled into Siberia. So there is, in addition to famine, man-made famine in Ukraine in the 1930s, there's also this tragedy of exile and suppression of national rebellion in Western Ukraine.
So back to you, William Pomerantz, for your scenario or scenarios with respect to what Putin is planning to do, both short and long term.
Right. Well, just to follow up on Ariel's one points about economics and so forth, can Russia go back? The answer is absolutely yes, it can go back. And there have been plenty of signs over the past 2 years since Putin has come back to power that he has exercised greater central control. He has reasserted the power vertical. He's busy creating a judicial vertical. There's plenty of reasons to suggest that Putin can gather more power. But what I would suggest is that he will do so with real economic costs and will come from the isolation of Russia. Now, there's an argument, of course, that Russia will continue to get various hard currencies from Europe and so forth. And I'm sure in Putin's equation that he can somehow survive that, that he will have enough, he has enough in terms of his the reserves and so forth, that he can survive.
What are his objectives right now?
I think on a certain level, the idea of simply having a destabilized Ukraine so that the elections from Russia's perspective are not viewed as legitimate is one approach that Putin is pursuing. I think the problem for Putin in this particular instance is that if indeed he only seeks to destabilize Ukraine but doesn't go any further, he runs the risk still of watching most of Ukraine move towards the EU. And I think that is something that Putin really cannot tolerate or will let stand. So I also think that if indeed that were the scenario, that he does nothing but tries to undermine the situation in Ukraine, causes problem in eastern Ukraine and so forth, I think that if all he has in the end is having taken Crimea but lost Ukraine, then that is not a winning strategy for Putin. I think he feels that. And that is why he will be tempted to go on to a second, third, or fourth scenario. But that because of a shrinking economy, he will need what Pleva called in 1905 a short little victorious war, and that he potentially will continue to need these types of events to help maintain his popularity inside of Russia. So what I'm saying is that if indeed he faces that dilemma, and I think that is something that is confronting Putin and Russia, then it becomes more likely that he moves more aggressively in Ukraine.
Okay, so back to you, Ariel Cohen. What can, should the United States, the West, do at this point? Why have we not imposed far more consequential sanctions upon Russia? Or do you think those are forthcoming right now, and would they deter him?
For a long time, the dominant opinion was that Mr. Putin is as much a businessman as he is a politician. I think his policy on Ukraine should make us question that assumption. Yes, he believes in state control over production of oil and gas. He probably views the Russian economy sort of the way the Bolsheviks looked at it during the time of NEP, New Economic Policy, so that the party controls the commanding heights, heavy industry, foreign trade, and then the service industries are semi-privatized. But there is something that emerges, and that is the steely determination to oppose the West. I think strategically, it's a huge mistake. Huge. Why? Because countries that really can fundamentally mess up Russian security are China, and China has the longest land border with the Russian Federation, bar none. China has an old historic grudge about the Eastern Siberian and Far Eastern lands that the Russian Empire took from the decaying Chinese Empire in the 17th century. And the second threat is radical Islam in North Caucasus and spillover from Central Asia all the way into such republics as even Tatarstan and Bashkortostan that were very, very moderate, but we witnessed the emergence of radical Sunni organizations there, some political assassinations, and of course, the soar of Chechnya, of Dagestan. So these are very, very serious problems. Now, Mr. Putin was trained as a Europeanist, as an expert on Germany. He speaks the language. He does not have the sensibilities, in my view, that apply to Islam. And his confrontation with the Sunni world in Syria may bring a very serious backlash that will be a real great pain in Russia's neck for the foreseeable future. But he decided what he decided. He decided to oppose the West, to oppose the most open-minded American president, bar none, in history, Mr. Obama.
The last word to you, William Pomerantz. 600 U.S. paratroopers in Poland and three Baltic states are no match for 80,000 troops along the Ukrainian border. We know about the misgivings on the part of Germany and other EU countries to really impose consequential sanctions to deter Russia. So where do we stand?
We would just have to wait and see whether economic sanctions could begin to bite, that could begin to change the tide. But I don't think 600 troops in Poland are going to have any influence on what Mr. Putin decides in Ukraine. Indeed, if the final issue that I would be concerned about, obviously, is that if indeed he succeeds in Ukraine, where does Putin go next?
And where he stops.
And where he stops, exactly. Because clearly the scenario that he is engaged in Ukraine applies directly to Kazakhstan and some several other former Soviet republics. And if he indeed he becomes so arrogant and he becomes so confident that he can continue to move, obviously the most dangerous potential spot is in the Baltic states, which are members of NATO, which would immediately trigger a response from NATO. So far, there's been rhetoric there, but really not any movement. So this is really a genuine world crisis that is ironic that on the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I, here we are again, where the odd shot could send the world tumbling into a major catastrophe.
Indeed, a most ominous note on which to end. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ariel Cohen, Senior Research Fellow in Russian and Eurasian Studies and International Energy Policy at the Heritage Foundation, and William Pomerantz, Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars. Thanks to both of you for your terrific insights. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Chiang Wong. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.